just by way of introduction, you know, we say every morning two brachos that seem very similar. We say, Ozer Yisrael b'gvura and Hanusein Layayev Koach. Both brachos ostensibly are praising God for bestowing upon us strength. And the Rav pointed out the difference between the two is that Hanusein Layayev Koach, to give someone who's tired strength, is referring to physical strength. A tired person is weak, and he needs physical strength to get back up and start walking around again. We wake up in the morning, we give a bracha to Hashem that we can walk around. But gvura, Ozer Yisrael b'gvura, gvura is referring to, as Rav called heroism, is referring to an inner strength, is referring to determination, or willpower, or self-control. And perhaps that's at least a piece of the theme tonight, self-control in today's society when we're bombarded with images that are not always so, you know, yashar images that are constantly surrounding us. So that gvura, to be able to tap into an appropriate amount of gvura, not too much, not too little, the appropriate amount of gvura, hopefully is one of the things we can discuss and learn from about tonight. I'd like to really give a very big, big thank you to Rabbi Swirsky, my Rebbe, and to Dr. Palkovitz, who I learned a tremendous amount from over the past years. Both of them have guided me in tremendous ways. I thank them for taking out their busy schedules, coming here tonight, discussing this very important topic, and sharing with us their insights. So we'll start, Smir Hashem, right now with Rabbi Swirsky.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Bacon. Can you hear me? I'm especially honored to be with you tonight, together with Dr. Palkovitz. I'm neither qualified nor is he interested in hearing my accolades. He doesn't need them, but suffice it to say that we're all privileged to have the benefit of his unique blend of Torah and Chochmah, which he brings to bear on such topics. I'd like to speak briefly, I think for 20 minutes or so, in this Hashem, and to divide my remarks a few minutes v'sha'avar, how a person should look retrospectively at past instances where he feels he's been nifshal, whether we're talking about an issur of zara levatel or whether we're talking about an issur of histaklus, ba'arayos, or any of these related issurim. A retrospective vantage point, and then to take a few minutes also to look towards the future, how a person, what measures and what strategies a person can adopt to try to avoid being nifshal in the future. I think any sensitive bentora, anyone who genuinely seeks to be Oved as Hashem, if he has been nechshal in any of these areas, instinctively feels a very strong, acute shame. And it's a sense of shame which Rachman Ratzlan can, it shouldn't, but can lead to a sense of yeyush. So that's one issue. How one deals with busha, that it shouldn't result in yeyush, in the sense of despair, in the sense of losing trust in oneself, belief in oneself. And also, another danger of the sense of shame and humiliation that a person feels is that it can often inhibit him from seeking out the guidance of the counsel, be it of a rav, be it of a psychologist, which could be invaluable to him. So how does a person navigate that? The Rambam, in the beginning of Perek Beis, of Hilchos Tshuva, again, being malakeh, various ma'amari chazal, the Rambam says that afilu kol yoma ba'avera, va'atsa tshuva b'yoma, so even if a person his entire life, rachmana litzlan, was about avera, and doesn't do tshuva until yom moso, until the day of his death, kol avonosav nimchalu. Kadosh Baruch Hu accepts that tshuva. Now, I'd like to pose a question. You'll see in a minute, the question is not mine. I'd like to pose a question. Well, what do we learn from this Rambam? What do I mean? What do we learn from this Rambam? So I'd like to tell you a story. My brother told me that he heard this story on a tape from the Talmud Rebbe in Yerushalayim. When he was a youngster, was Mishamish, the Gerer Rebbe, the Beis Yisrael. A friend of his who knew that he had access to the Gerer Rebbe sent him a question that a friend of his, in turn, came to him deeply, deeply distressed that he had this inclination to Shmad. Rachmana litzlan, he had this inclination, this almost irrational pull that he should shmad to Christianity. He had no, intellectually he knew, he had no sveikis that Torah is absolute truth, and yet there was something pulling him, there was something drawing him, and he didn't know what to do. So he asked that he should go, that he asked his friend who was Mishamish, the Gerer Rebbe, that he should go into the Beis Yisrael, and he should get an etzah from the Beis Yisrael what he should do. And the Beis Yisrael heard the question, and he heard that a Jew was tormented by such struggles, so he was deeply distressed. He begins pacing back and forth. After a few minutes of pacing back and forth, he asks for a Gemara Shabbos. He opens the Gemara Shabbos, points to a maimon, where the Gemara says that kol ha'omer omer yehesh meirah b'chol kochel, afilu yesh bo shemet avodah zarah kedoro shel enosh is mochlumo. The person answers amen yehesh meirah b'chol kochel, different pshatim in the Rishonim, where the b'chol kochel means that he's totally focused. It also means that he answers loud with all his strength and with all his energy. So even if he's tainted by avodah zarah, like doro shel enosh, which introduced avodah zarah into the world, is mochlumo. So the Gerer Rebbe, the Beis Yisrael, points to this Gemara and says, what's the limud from this Gemara? What do you learn from this Gemara? So his Mishamish says to him, I think what all of us would have said. You learn that if a person answers Amen Yehesh Meirah B'chol Kochel, even if he has a Shemet Avodah Zarah like Doro Shel Enosh, is Nimcha. So the Gerer Rebbe says, no, that's not what you learn from this Gemara. He points to it again and says, what do you learn from this Gemara? So the Gerer Rebbe says, what you learn from this Gemara is that even if he has a Shemet Avodah Zarah Kedar Shel Enosh, he's capable of answering Amen Yehesh Meirah B'chol Kochel. That's what you learn from the Gemara, says the Gerer Rebbe. So transposing this profound insight of the Gerer Rebbe into the Ma'amari Chazal that the Rambam quotes at the beginning of Perek Beis of Hilchos Tshuva. So what do you learn when the Gerer Rebbe is phraseology? What's the limud when Chazal tell us that afilu kol yoma v'avera and atza tshuva b'yom misasa kol avonosav nimcholim? What you learn from that is that the power and the capacity of bechira chafshis, the ability that a person has to do tshuva, is so great that even if he spent a lifetime, Rachmana Litzlan, even if he spent a lifetime mired in chait, he's still capable of doing tshuva. Halachas kama v'kama young people. Halachas kama young people who don't have that many years of negative momentum to overcome. So what you see from that halacha is that a person always has that capacity to do tshuva.
And as we say in Tfilas Ne'ilah, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is waiting for it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants it. Habali Toyed, Messiah Natsa. So there is no room for Yayush. A person has that capacity. HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises us that if only we genuinely and sincerely want to do tshuva, so he's going to help us. What better promise, what better guarantee could we ask for? There's no room for Yayush. There is a vort from the Koske Rebbe. Often with the first Gemara that to which we're introduced is Eilam Metzius. So the first big sugya is Yayush Shalom Midas. So the Koske Rebbe says that the way to read on one level, he doesn't mean to the exclusion of other levels, the way to read it is that Yayush Shalom Midas. A person is Mesiyash, that's an indication that he's not thinking. The das is not operative. There's no room for Yayush. It's not to say that to do tshuva is necessarily the easiest, the simplest thing. It's not to say that it doesn't require concerted effort and hard work, but it's always possible, and the Ribbono Shel Olam is always standing at our side to assist us in that endeavor. Now, what about the other issue in terms of being inhibited from asking for help, for guidance, be it from a rav, be it from a psychologist, be it from a rav who is a psychologist, from a psychologist who is a rav, because of this sense of shame. So, not every case. It could be that maybe from what a person hears in a public forum or reads, maybe he doesn't need personalized advice. If he doesn't need personalized advice, then there is no mitzvah to go confide in a rav or a psychologist. Ashrei nesui pashek, soy chato. There's no mitzvah to advertise the chait. If a person doesn't need personalized guidance, if that's genuinely the case, fine, then there's no issue. But often it's not the case. Often it's not so simple. Often we would benefit from some kind of personalized, individualized advice and guidance. And then the issue is that we feel inhibited from doing so because of our sense of shame, because of our sense of embarrassment. So I'd just like to give some perspectives. The point of these perspectives is not to eliminate the sense of shame. The sense of busha is crucial. Busha is indispensable to doing tshuva. The psukim say it, and that's why it's quoted lahalacha as well, right? In Slichos, we say that Ezra Hashbofer Omer Lefanech Elokai Boshti V'Nechlamti. Boshti V'Nechlamti. The Rambam, when he gives us the quintessential definition of vidui, so the Rambam says that the person says that chatosi avisi pashati lefanecha asisi kach vekach and boshti v'nichanti or nichanti uboshti b'masai ul'olam eini chozer bohem. So when the Rambam is giving us again just the bare essentials, the busha is there. So I'm not looking to eliminate busha from our sense of reaction. I'm not looking to induce a sense of complacency. There is an indispensable role that busha plays. But that busha shouldn't be crippling. So the one or two perspectives that I'd like to share with you is that the busha should be something which galvanizes a person to do tshuva as opposed to inhibiting him from seeking guidance as opposed to crippling him. First of all, one of the reasons that people feel such acute shame and humiliation, which prevents them from getting the personalized, individualized guidance which they need, is because they feel very alone in their failures. And the reason for that is, for correctly, appropriately, none of us go around advertising our flaws and our what we've been nichshal in. Again, we're not supposed to. Ashrei nesui pashek, soy chato. So because of that, so when a person is nichshel in something, a person often feels very much alone. A person feels like everyone else, so eichshehu, everyone else is omed b'nisayim. Everyone else is able to successfully deal with these challenges, and I'm the one, I'm the only one who fails. And that sense of aloneness magnifies a sense of shame, and often that can then prevent the person from seeking that individualized, personalized guidance. I can't give you statistics. I can't imagine that even munchen, big munchen, can give statistics, but this much, I can assure you, is that anyone who's struggling with these issues is not alone. Is not alone and is far, far from alone. And again, appropriately, no one knows what anyone else is struggling with. No one else, no one listens in on anyone else's al-chayt on Yom Kippur. But that sense of aloneness is a false one. It's a big, big nisayon. It's a big, big problem in our generation. Many, many people are struggling with it, and if anyone knows that he is struggling with it, so trust me that you're not alone in that struggle. And there's no reason for the shame to be magnified by that sense. The other thing which needs to be understood is that when one goes to a rav, a psychologist who's a rav, wherever you're going to, for guidance, for help, if that person, if the rav, if the psychologist is worth his salt, is a bona fide rav, a psychologist, the last thing in the world he's interested in doing is judging you. He's not there to judge you. He's there to help you. And he's not forming any judgments either. Judgments is the Ribon Shalom's prerogative. If there's a din Torah, which has to be adjudicated in Bezdin, so then b'les breira, so Bezdin judges. But unless we're absolutely forced to judge, we don't judge people. Ki ha-mishpat le'elokinu. That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's prerogative. There are many, many reasons why that's the sole jurisdiction and prerogative of the Ribon Shel Olam. But one of them is, one of the reasons, which perhaps is most germane to what we're discussing tonight, is that to judge someone else and to condemn someone else for his failings or his shortcomings is not something a person can do unless he's perfect. And since Ein HaTzmimus Bilti LaHashem Levado, since only HaKadosh Baruch Hu is perfect, it doesn't give anyone a right to judge anyone else. So when we go to a rav or to a psychologist for guidance, for Eitza, and to do so, we have to confide in him. The last thing in the world that person is ever going to do is to judge. And if anything, the most profound impression that will be made is the sincerity that the person displays in looking to do tshuva. So for these reasons, the sense of busha should be there. It should be part of the tshuva process. A person can't do tshuva without having a sense of busha, but never ever should it be magnified to a sense where a person is either misya'esh or where he's inhibited from seeking guidance. On a more technical level, there is a tshuva in Igros Moshe about what someone asked of Moshe for a seida ha-tshuva, for how to do tshuva for the chet of Zera Levatola. And Moshe takes a very different approach than that which those who sort of approach it more from Al-Pi Kabbalah. And Moshe says that in terms of the Chiluke Kapara, so this doesn't belong with Chayvik Priestos and Chayvik Mises Bezdin. It belongs more with the second group, with the second group of Lavin. And Moshe says that the main thing to do is and we'll talk some more about this in the future, is that a person should do his best and take precautions to avoid it in the future. We're about to talk about that, Linader. A person should be ma'aser the Talmud Torah, and Moshe says the first year of doing tshuva, a person should fast once every 2 months. The second year, a person should fast once every 3 months. The third year, a person fasts once every 6 months, and that's it. And that's all that Moshe insists on. A person wants to do more? Okay, so there are other svarim that have other regimens as well. But that's what Rav Moshe writes in Igros Moshe. In terms of looking to the future, how a person takes precautions to try to avoid being nitchel. So if we had to describe Chazal's approach to attaining and maintaining Kedusha and how to choose a few key words, so one of those key words would be that Chazal were very realistic. Chazal, the Torah, is very, very realistic. Part of that realism is that the Torah recognizes and Chazal draw our attention to the fact that one of the strongest Yetzirahs that we have, second to none, is the Yetzirah for Arayis. And obviously the issue of Zera Levatola is obviously part and parcel of that. Ein l'chadav v'chadotav kula shu kosha v'rofa on lifrosh ele min ha'arayos v'habiyos ha'atzuros. There's nothing which is as difficult for a person to be nizar on than when it comes to arayos and when it comes to biyos ha'atzuros. Amu chachomim gezel v'arayos nafsha shel odem mis'av elohem u'mecham dosad. It's interesting, according to the Rambam, the urge, the drive that we have in this area is so strong that this is one of the very handful of places where the Torah itself has a siyag d'oraisa. The Rambam is of the opinion, of course, that l'sikrivu l'gavos erva, that the prohibition not to engage in things which can lead to gilui arayos, whether it's chibuk and nishuk, whether it's kissing and hugging or any kind of affectionate physical contact or even affectionate conversation which can or even what a person sees and looks at, anything which is conducive to leading to gilui arayos. So the Torah itself prohibits this as a siyog. For the most part, the Torah left that to Chazal. Here the Torah itself introduces the siyog, which certainly points, again, to, it attests to the fact of just how strong that urge and drive is within the human psyche. Now, Moshe Lamad Dovadome, when you're on the road, sometimes you see these tankers which are transporting petroleum. And you see that there's usually a sign on the tanker which says that there's a highly flammable substance inside, and make sure you keep a safe distance. That the stronger and the more powerful the Yetzer Hara, so the more realistic one has to be in dealing with it. Let's try to just for a moment elaborate a little bit on the psychology and the strategy of the siyog d'oraisa. It doesn't make a difference whether you hold like the Ramban or the Rabbana. The point is the same. Of l'sikrivu l'gavos erva. And take a for instance. What's so terrible? Why is it that it's absolutely forbidden for a couple that's not married? Maybe they're even engaged. Maybe they're dating. What's so terrible if they hold hands? Right? So we know that that's obviously awesome. Why is it so terrible? So people often don't understand it. So one of the reasons, again, not to suggest that this is the only reason, but one of the reasons is this: that Yorda Torah Sof Daito Shel Adam. It's much easier to deal with a Yetzer Hara which is potentially so strong, if you don't allow it to become at all inflamed. The more you feed that Yetzer Hara, So then, the more difficult it is to, the more difficult it is to control. So is there a Yetzirah to hold hands? Yeah, there's a Yetzirah to hold hands. And maybe even a strong Yetzirah. The Yetzirah to hold hands is not nearly as strong as if the couple is holding hands, as the Yetzirah is to engage in Chibut v'Nishut. Because once they're holding hands, so that's Megawa the Yetzirah, right? It says in Shulchan Aruch, in Siman Shin Zayin Aruch Chayim, the Giwa Yetzirah, instigating the Yetzirah is also. Because once they hold hands, there wasn't as much of a Yetzirah to hold hands, but if they do that, so then the Yetzirah to not only hold hands, but the Chibut v'Nishuk, so that Yetzirah is even stronger. And if they proceed to the next stage of Chibut v'Nishuk, so then the Yetzirah to go even further, at each stage, the Yetzirah becomes exponentially stronger. And to withstand the Yetzirah becomes, the challenge becomes magnified a hundredfold, if not more. Which is why Yor Detala Sov Daita Shel Adam, that the way to be able to withstand the Yetzirah is not to allow it to gain any momentum, not to allow it to be incited at all, not to allow it to be instigated at all. So therefore, you know what? Let there be no physical contact. Let there be no conversation which is provocative, because that's the easiest and most realistic way to deal with the Yetzirah. So the same is true in terms of all kinds of Rabbi Bacon mentioned the images, whether it's the pornography, which is just so pervasive and rampant on the internet, whether it's just even the exposure that one has sometimes by walking in the street. But here, there's just one other perspective that we need to have, and that is the following: we live in a crazy society. That sounds right. It sounds like it's a fanatical statement. Sounds like it's a radical statement. No, it's a very temperate, moderate statement. We live in a crazy, crazy society. We live in a society which is obsessed with everything that has to do with Inyanei Tashmish. Even so-called news stations, the attention they pay to any crimes which have to do which relate to this area and the lurid detail in which the stories are reported, we live in a society which is just totally obsessed. That's this is the legacy of the 60s, which is totally obsessed with anything and everything relating to Inyanei Tashmish Shamita, relating to sexuality, and it's discussed in the most vulgar fashion, and there's absolutely no sense of tznius whatsoever in the society. That's just a factual description. It's not kanos. It's a factual description. If you just compare what society is today to what it was 50 years ago, not just relative to the Torah, but relative to itself, you see just how much society has deteriorated. So the result is that in order to adopt those siyogim which are necessary to avoid the Yetzirah being incited and instigated, there's an awful lot of popular culture which is just off-limits. An awful lot of popular culture, which is off-limits. The so-called, highbrow news magazines are disgusting. And certainly fall into the, and parts of them, probably in every single issue, fall into the category of divrei cheshek, which is megara the Yetzirah. It certainly doesn't allow for taharas hamachshava, which is one of the main
jyogin that a person looks to put into place to avoid the constant provocations. It's not consistent with Shmiras Shainayim either in terms of the types of pictures which are featured in such publications. In terms of the internet, Mesilas Yesharim says that in general that a person is supposed to that the idea of Asus Yog LaTorah is not only a mandate for Chazal to introduce siyogim which are binding upon all of us, but it's also a mandate for every individual to introduce personal siyogim. So if I know that I have certain weaknesses, so even if there is no mitzvah d'rabbanan which addresses my weaknesses, I have to introduce an individualized, personalized siyogim to deal with those weaknesses. If I find that the too often on Shabbos, I forget for a minute and I flip the switch, so there's no din that says that you have to have covers on your light switches on Shabbos. There's no din d'rabbanan that requires it. But if I see that the time and time again I'm nifshel in doing that, so then the Mesilas Yesharim says, so I should do that, so I should go out and I should get covers for my light switches to take that preventive measure that I won't do it again. So if a person knows that he has a temptation when he's using the internet to go to sites which are going to be metame him. So if it's realistic that he shouldn't use the internet at all, so matzavu manoi. If it's not realistic that he shouldn't use the internet at all, so then he has to introduce, according to the Mesilas Yesharim, personalized siyogim. So only use the internet in a very public setting, where everyone sees what you're doing. So then if everyone sees what we're doing, so then we have that extra inhibition about doing things and looking at things which are inappropriate. So a person has to look for those, again, personalized siyogim. When you walk on the street in the summertime, when the weather is warm, so yeah, as much as possible, if a person is walking in a neighborhood where it's a problem, so a person looks down. A person doesn't look up all the time, because inevitably, the more he looks up, the more he's going to see that he shouldn't see, that he shouldn't see. So a person has to look to see what the appropriate siyogim are that he can put into place. Most of all. The most powerful deterrent, and with this I'll conclude, the most powerful deterrent to chate is that a person has a sense of being in the presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam. When a person feels that there's an ayin roah, the ozen shamat, v'chol ma'aseichu b'sechem nechsavim, when a person is aware of that, so to the extent and to the degree that he's aware of that, so to that extent and to that degree, he's inhibited from chait. And it's something which every one of us needs to try to reinforce and internalize even more and more, the sense of ayin roah v'ozen shamat. The same way, sitting on floor two of the library, so we're not gonna go to inappropriate sites on the computer. So there's always an ayin roah and ozen shamat. Who do they tell the story? Is it with the Chafetz Chaim? They tell the story that the wagon driver pulls over to the side and he's going to go rob from the field, and he tells the Chafetz Chaim, "You be the lookout man while I steal. And if anyone's coming, so yell." So the wagon driver goes, the balagala goes. He's about to close the food. The Chafetz Chaim yells, "Stop! Someone's watching." The guy looks around and says, "No one here." Again, Chaim yells, "Stop!" He says, "The Ribbono Shel Olam's watching." So how do we internalize it? So that's a separate shmooze. But al regel achas, the way we internalize something we know, the way we internalize it, that we feel it, and then we're always conscious of it, is just by reinforcing it. 50 times a day, if there's an index card that's not needed for a question here, take one of Rabbi Bacon's index cards. Write down on the index card. Write down.
Ayin Roah, Ozen Shomat. Write down. I want to be close to the Ribon Shel Olam. I don't want to do things which are going to be metame me, and which are going to keep me distant from the Ribon Shel Olam. Write down, having mechashev, schar mitzvah keneged hafseida, schar aveira keneged hafseida. If we write these things down, the only way we can sin, Edom Chote, Eom Kein Nechnas Baruch Shlos, is if a person is distracted from what we all know and what we all ultimately want. So the kunst in life is not to be distracted. If a person is not distracted, there's no nisayon which is too big, there's no nisayon which is too difficult. A nisayon only becomes too big or too difficult when we don't have, again, the support and the inhibition of a feeling of Yer Shamayim. We lose that when we get distracted. In order not to get distracted, we have to internalize the Yer Shamayim. The way we internalize it is by telling it to ourselves again and again and again and again, and then it becomes embedded in our consciousness. It becomes embedded in our consciousness. L'man tia yeroso al panechem levilti sechato.
Yeah, first, let me start by saying how impressed I am with you guys, okay? I frankly wasn't expecting there to be such a nice turnout. And it says something very nice that you're here, you know. You do a computer search, a cyclist search, or a search on the various databases looking at the issue of self-control and sexuality, or self-control and masturbatory behavior. Nothing comes up. Nothing comes up. Or very little comes up. Maybe a little bit comes up about excessive autoerratic behavior in mentally retarded populations. But it's not considered a problem in the secular world out there. And I'm looking at you and thinking what a wonderful reflection it is on all of you that you're rejecting that aspect of society that's not so easy to reject. The Satmar Rebbe in 1950 said that his chassidim, in one bus ride from Williamsburg to Manhattan, saw more than their grandparents did in a lifetime in the shtetl. I don't know what they saw in 1950. I can't even imagine. And you think about that and you compare it to one session on the internet, in the privacy of your bedroom. Earlier today, I was doing some research to prepare for a talk I had to give. And I had to find an article in the New York Times. I do a search to find the article. An article comes up. And alongside the article is a pornographic picture. And I started thinking, it's almost impossible. Not, Shmiras HaEinayim is so difficult in today's age. Do you know that the average age in this country, the kids are first exposed to pornography, is age 11. And it's almost always accidental. So that even if you have the purest of intentions, even if you have the best focus in the world, it's virtually impossible on the internet not to be faced with the, you know, megaton equivalent of what the Satmar Chassidim on the bus ride to Manhattan faced in 1950. Okay, that's point number one. Point number two is just related to this. It's the frog in the beaker analogy. It's the kal v'chomer. Frog in the beaker. Take a frog, throw it in a beaker of boiling water, it'll jump out and save its life. Take the same frog, throw it in a beaker of water, I'm sorry, put it in the beaker of water that's normal temperature, but over a low simmering fire that goes up a degree at a time. It won't realize it's in mortal danger, and it'll boil to death. And I think that the nimshel is fairly obvious. The nimshel is that we're not even aware of how things are changing because the change is a little bit too gradual for us to notice. But the R of today's movies, okay, is very different than what it took to get an R rating a generation ago. There's a foundation called the Kaiser Family Foundation that every 2 years takes the pulse of sexual content on sitcoms on television. And it's amazing what's happened just in a 2 year period of time. Last time they did it, there was a tremendous increase, not just in what's shown and what's acceptable to be shown on primetime television, but perhaps even more ominously, for the first time about 4 or 5 years ago, they broke the barrier in terms of showing sexual contact between couples in a way that sort of shows that it's okay to do this with no interpersonal obligation, meaningless physical contact, just for the sake of pleasure. That used to be taboo until relatively recently. Now it's become the norm just probably in the last 4 to 6 years if you look carefully at the data. What's my point? My point is that the antidote to the boiling temperature around us is to name the monster. The antidote is to talk about it, is to focus on it, is to say, as Rav Tversky so beautifully was describing with the beautiful insights of Torah, which are so much deeper than the insights of psychology, that we have to focus it and come up with a plan that takes us from the passive to the active and to a constructive kind of shame that is not a pathological shame, but a wake-up call that we have to think about this, which is why I'm so happy that Rabbi Bacon and his colleagues organized this program. Okay, couple of basic points. Number one, just to echo what Rav Tversky was saying, you know, there is nothing tougher. We're talking about something that is, for young, healthy guys, is a very, very powerful force. And a very powerful force to control in any setting, but certainly living in Manhattan in this day and age with the lifestyles that we've chosen to live. I find very poignant the second part of the Rambam that Rabbi Tversky quoted, right? So the second part of that Rambam is Emel Chadaber b'chol Torah kula shehu kasha l'rofa om lifrosh elemen harayos babios ha'atzuros amru chachamim v'shosh en etzavu Yisrael al harayos bachu v'kiblu mitzvah zu b'tarumos u'b'chiyah. Okay? That encapsulates it. This is tough. It's tough. On the other hand, what I want to do is just briefly review with you some tricks from psychology, some ideas from psychology about how to handle this very difficult task in a way that will hopefully make it more a little bit more manageable. Number one, the way we look at this is crucial. I want to take you through a couple of core points. And the first point is the point that we've already made, but I want to make it a little bit differently. And it's the point that the research shows that when you take a goal in terms of self-control and you change it from threat to challenge, the research shows that at the moment that you change the goal from threat to challenge, listen to what a whole series of studies show. When you go from threat to challenge, automatically you have greater persistence in your efforts to control that area. Your thinking becomes more clear, not clouded by guilt and non-productive aspects of shame, and even more efficient physiological responses. It focuses you. So if you see it as, oh, this is a threat, it's a terrible thing, and you push away from it, I'm going to show you a little bit later, it makes it much tougher. If instead you say, you know, the purpose of life is lamod v'nisyon, kilkach no tzarti, this is my challenge. And what I always like to think about is the beautiful insight of the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, on hafsek b'musar al teref nisroch yehi chayecha. Many of you have heard this. It is such an important psychological concept. The Gra says on the Pasuk in Mishlei, of Hasek b'Mussar al Teref Nitzra Kehis Hayecha, latch on to self-correction. Don't weaken. Nitzra Kehis Hayecha. What does he say? He says, Ki Masha Ha'adam Chai. Kedei lishvar mashalo shavar adhena osa hamida. The purpose of life is to shir samidas, right? It's to struggle with that which is most difficult to struggle with. Because otherwise, he goes on to say, lamalo chayim. What's the purpose of life? What he means is that the point that you're struggling, especially in a society such as ours, with self-control in this area, you're literally fulfilling your tafkid in life. There's nothing more important. What a challenge. It's a great challenge. It's a challenge. It's a heroic challenge. So when you're having a hard time with it, of course you are. That's life. That's the challenge of life. But when you're able to rise to the challenge and put it front and center in your mattering map, it makes an enormous difference. So recommendation number one is go from threat to challenge. Okay? Right? Because otherwise, lama lo chayim. Okay, so it's the Gaon's recommendation. We have a lot of psychology to back it up. Okay, so that's recommendation number one. Number two. Number two is it is almost impossible. And again, I find myself echoing what Rav Twersky said, which is always the case, because all that psychology really is reflecting this wisdom. We know that when it comes to self-control, monitoring is key. Monitoring is key. Research over and over again in terms of self-control shows that it is exceedingly difficult to control behavior that is not carefully monitored. Now, you could do it using Musar techniques of Cheshbon HaNefesh, which I imagine at some point you've heard about or talked about. You could do it by some kind of mental monitoring of how you're doing. Maybe it could be written down in some ways that are acceptable to you, or, as was discussed already, to the extent that you could turn to somebody else maybe to help you with the monitoring. There's something about going from an animalistic response where we give in to our animalistic desires, and instead having the frontal prefrontal connections take over, having our mature brain take over, that is facilitated by monitoring, thinking about it, making it into a goal, making it not only into a challenge, but making it into a goal that you're very specific about, and then tracking your progress. We're going to talk about how to handle failure in a few minutes. But monitoring is the key, okay? Breakdowns in self-regulation. If you want to get the key bottom line finding from the research, it's that breakdowns in self-regulation are almost always associated with ceasing to monitor one's behavior. So that's point number two. It's the point of the need to track. You have to track. If you don't track, the default setting that's going to take over is going to be a problem. It's going to be a problem, especially with such a powerful set of temptations. Okay? Number three, the research shows that the beginning is toughest. Kolos Kolos Kasha, right? You know, nobody says it better than the Gemara at the end of Sukkah, that according to the way it's understood by some of the Farshim, right, Amar of Yochanan, Aver katan yeshlo la'adam, marivo saveya, masbio raiv, right? Okay, so it's a famous Gemara. It says that in terms of controlling this incredibly strong force, if you feed it, it remains hungry. If you feed the urge, if you feed the temptation, the more you feed it, as we were just hearing, the more the tava will grow. But if you starve it, it'll be satisfied. There's strong research in psychology that shows that. The research in psychology shows us that self-control is actually like a muscle. It's like a muscle. It's like a muscle that you exercise. You actually get tired from exercising it at the beginning. But if you just stick with it for just a couple of weeks of exercising self-control, what the research clearly shows is it starts to get easier. So the toughest part is the beginning stages of self-control. It's exactly like a muscle. You get much better as time goes on, and once you work out the kinks and you get used to it, it starts to become somewhat easier, and sometimes much easier. You just get into the habit of those gedarim working, and it's not nearly as much of a temptation once you set in a set of gedarim that work for you. Now, for everybody, it's going to be different. Some people are more visual, others are more into fantasy, others are more into being helped by talking out and reaching out to others. Everybody has to have their own toolbox of coping mechanisms in terms of what works for their unique set of self-control strategies. But the key is that, in terms of this third main point, is remember that it's very, very hard, but it's far from impossible. And there's strong research. By the way, I'm going to, I already did post this. If you want, I have a PowerPoint that goes into much more detail on this with specifics and with references and things like that. So it's the easiest way. I have it on that website. I have, or else should I just, you guys could post it, or should I? Here, I'm telling you to use the, what is it? I'm telling you to use the internet. What is it? What's that whole thing about the, right? The medicine, the refu, and the macha are all somehow mixed into one. Okay. Okay, what could you do? Anyway, we could figure out a way to distribute it. Okay, great. Okay, so if you want to just look at it to make sure, if you could please look at it to make sure that it's okay. Okay? So you could feel free to get rid of any part of it you want. Okay? Okay. Okay. Number four. Okay? I like being sensitive. It's good for me. Okay. Okay. Number four is the most common question, the most common problem, and that's if we dim the lights now, and I told you, let's close our eyes and spend the next 10 minutes not thinking of a pink elephant. Whatever you do, don't think of a pink elephant. What happens? Okay? In psychological terms, what the research shows is that there are two systems. There's the monitoring system and self-regulation. So the monitoring system is, if you're trying to oster yourself from something, you monitor the environment for that thing you're trying to oster. So if you're trying to give up eating cheesecake or chomps or whatever, okay, you're always on the lookout for that because you have to see it so that you could have the proper harfuffas from it. Then the other process, psychologists call the operating process, and that's the controls. The problem is that the more either stressed out we become or the more depressed we become, the more likely we are to have the monitoring process work while the operating process doesn't work. To put it to plain English, what it means is the following. Let's say I'm very stressed out. Let's say it's in the middle of finals or midterms. Or let's say I'm having a fight with my roommate or I'm having other kinds of stress in my life. Or let's say I'm depressed, okay? And this is an area that I'm having a hard time with. You're still going to be on the lookout automatically for the thing that pulls you into the problem of self-control that you're having. But your control system is not going to be working very well. Just again, self-control is a muscle. It's a muscle. So the monitoring tends to work even under stress. The control doesn't work well under stress. And then what tends to happen is the downward spiral. The downward spiral. As a matter of fact, there's some fascinating, relatively new research that shows the more you try to suppress an unwanted sexual thought, the more energy your body expends and the more drawn to this thought it becomes. There's some interesting biofeedback in neurophysiologic research that's showing that. It's a very interesting part of the saucer. So as you try to fight it, the more you fight something, the stronger the taiva becomes. So what's the answer? What's the answer? The answer is, and this is where I really need you to make sure this is okay, is, and I don't want to just put, I just need guidance on this. The answer is the Yinanea Lo Rosho answer. The answer is that there is a way to fight off an unwanted thought from a psychological standpoint, by robbing it of its power while not strengthening it, right? And it's all hinted at in the very famous Gemara in Yevamos, where Rav Akiva's in a shipwreck, and he says nizdamenli, I'm sorry, dashel spina nizdamenli. Says a plank of wood came my way. V'chol gal shaba olai, then nasi li roshi. Mikanam ruchachamin im yavo rishom al adam yinanea lo rosha. Right? That was, you ride the wave. You ride the wave. The more you fight a wave, you all know it, okay? The more you fight a wave, the more likely you are to be sucked into the undercurrent, into the undertow. The more you ride a wave instead of fighting it, the more likely you are to not be sucked into to be sucked into this paradox. So what do I mean by this? Let's get very specific in terms of recommendations on this point. Is you as you feel yourself getting pulled in to the fantasies or to the whatever the thought process is that you do before before having a problem with Hatzar Sarlabatol, let's say, okay? Or before you have a problem in terms of getting into a physical relationship with the girl. What you do at that point is you mentally step back, you acknowledge to yourself, okay, this is the way it starts, okay? But you don't get pulled into wrestling it. It's like what Vessler says in Mesomelio, the more you push down on the spring of a mattress, the more resistance you're gonna get. You don't push back on it. What you do instead is you reassure yourself, okay, this is the struggle. This is the challenge. You don't analyze it. Don't get pulled into fighting with yourself. Don't get pulled into the struggle. Instead, at that point, you let it ride over you, and then you take some kind of specific action that does not involve getting pulled into the fantasy. So the specific action may be to distract yourself. It may be to go into the room where there are other guys hanging around. It may be to, whatever it is your coping plan is, you go and get yourself away from it, but you don't fight the obsession. Instead, you have it right over you. I know it's a little bit of a concept that may be a little bit difficult to get, but it's, I think, a very powerful concept, and it's explained a little bit more on what you'll see. Okay? So you say to yourself, this thought isn't helpful right now. Maybe Rutorsky will be able to talk about this more later from more of an appropriate hashgacha kind of standpoint. Final set of points. By the way, so there's something in psychology called chain analysis. Chain analysis is, if you're having a problem, so let's say the problem is, the problem is that you know that you get very pulled and you walk into your room and you're alone. Let's say your roommate's nowhere around and you go onto the internet and you know that's the first step in terms of your getting into Hatzar Sarlabatol, okay? So at that point, how do you deal with it? So I already said, so step one is the monitoring process. Step two is the real decision to do something about this. You make it into a goal, you make it into a challenge, you focus on it. Step three also, forget the numbers, but something I didn't say before is the more specific you are in terms of your planning, the more effective it's going to be. The chain analysis goes like this. They ask a set of questions. At every point of the chain, what are the gedarim I can put up, okay? So what you say to yourself, number one, is what prompting event in the environment is the beginning of the chain? So it might be the prompting event is I walk into my room and my roommate's not around. Or it might be I'm feeling really down, I'm feeling really stressed, and I know that this behavior gives me a short-term fix, okay? Or it may be just sort of an internal feeling that you're just sort of drawn to it. But the more you get tuned into that step one of the chain, the beginning parts of the chain, the easier it's going to be to come up with some kind of coping plan. Okay? What things in my environment make me vulnerable? Okay? And you actually get very specific in terms of the behaviors and events. And then, if you're nechshel, let's say you give in. This is where it becomes very important, just sort of as a corollary to talking about the state of Yiddish. You go from seeing it as a setback to seeing it as feedback. Okay, the research shows us if you change it into a learning experience, you say to yourself, look, I'm not happy with myself, right? The shame is good if it energizes you to a new plan. Okay, and the new plan becomes, okay, how can I learn from this for the future? See, there's a tendency to say, look, I blew it, I might as well forget about it for this month, I'll wait till Elul, you know. Ekdev Ashev, because that's very much that part of that in many of us. Or, maybe after finals. There's a tendency to do that. And what you have to do is you have to, there's something called harm reduction in psychology, right? There's the Gemara tells us, there's a great imagery in the Gemara in Shabbos. Darsh Revula, Maidach Siv Artur Shaharbe. What does it mean? You shouldn't be too much of a Rasha. Harbe hu de lo lirsha, hum at lirsha? What do you mean? There's like gradations there. Ella, Mishach al shum v'recho nodev, right? Let's say you have a little bit of garlic and your breath smells, okay? Yachzer v'yoch al shum achar v'yehei recho nodev. So is the answer to just keep on stuffing the garlic so your breath really smells? Of course not. You realize that sometimes the answer is, okay, I made a mistake, I'll do tshuva on it. Let me figure out, what can I learn from this mistake? Some of you have heard me say this. One of my favorite studies is the neurosurgeon study. A medical sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania wanted to understand what differentiates between the top 1% of all neurosurgeons. It's very hard to become a neurosurgeon, right? 4 years medical school, I think 5 years of general surgery, then you're not even finished till you're in your mid-30s. I think it's longer than a Chafetz Chaim smicha. It's not easy, okay? So you go forever, okay? And you're finally a neurosurgeon. What differentiates between the top 1% of neurosurgeons, okay, who are the best of the best, have the fewest deaths, and the regular neurosurgeons, and the bottom 1% who get fired from the residency programs? And it turns out, you think it's intelligence, you think it's manual dexterity. No, you know what it is? It's how they handle their mistakes. Top 1% of neurosurgeons, they make a mistake, they're energized by it. They're not happy, but they say, I'm not going home until I figure out what I did wrong. And they go to the library and they call the experts and they go to the animal lab and do operations on these poor animals till they figure out what they did wrong. And then, ultimately, they figure out, they embrace it. They embrace it till they understand what they did wrong. The bottom 1%, the ones who end up getting fired, if they make a mistake, not a good thing to make a mistake when you're a neurosurgeon, right? If they make a mistake, they'll say, oh, it's, the lighting was terrible in the operating room today. Oh, it's that nursing staff. We had such horrible OR nurses today. It's all out there. It's how we embrace our mistakes that determine where we're going in terms of our personal growth. So that's the final point. Final point is the point of yish versus learning from our mistakes. So we ask ourselves, that's the last set of questions, how can I reduce my vulnerability in the future? What harm did my problem behavior cause? What am I doing to myself? How badly do I feel about it? You do the cost-benefit analysis. You don't run away from the productive aspects of busha. And I think you pull this all together. I didn't give you any magic. And I don't think Rav Tversky gave us any magic. But it's an approach. And it's an approach that is based on some very, very real wisdom. Very real wisdom. The wisdom of Torah and some of the new insights in the field of psychology that's really telling us that, again, let's just summarize it. Number one is set the goals. Well, the Buzetzer Rebbe, I think, I have some Chavitza Talmidim. He tells Talmidim to have 6 month plans. Where do you want to be in 6 months, right? Where do you want to be in 6 months? When you set goals, it makes an enormous difference. And in terms of this area, what are your goals? You're just going to let it happen, or are you going to fight it off? And is it a worthy thing to fight off? Right? I think we're all in agreement. It's a worthy. Do you know self-control? There's a fascinating study, one of the leading, one of the most quoted studies in psychology. Is a study done just a few blocks down by a Dr. Michelle at Columbia Psychology Department. What did he do? He looks at a group of four-year-olds years ago, a generation ago, and he gave them, let's say, two cookies or two marshmallows. And he said, look, I'm going to leave one cookie with you, okay, and I'm going to take the other cookie. I'll be back in 5 minutes. If you want to, you could eat the cookie now. Okay, you could eat the cookie now, that's fine. But if you wait for the 5 minutes, when I come back, you're going to get both cookies. So eat whenever you want to. Whether or not, in that little brief 5 minute study, the kids were able to wait predicted their success in life. The kids who were able to wait, the kids who were able to show self-control, the kids who were able to have that maturity at age 4, in young adulthood showed better outcomes socially, emotionally, in about some like 10 different measures. It's really an amazing thing to see. Follow them up into adulthood. Just that one thing, self-control in relationships before you're married, is incredibly important. So much of what goes into a success in marriage is being able to relate to your wife one day in a way that you don't sexualize your dependencies, meaning being able to find intimacy in a non-sexual way. That's what the beauty of Taras Mishpacha and of the cycle of a Jewish marriage is about. That to the extent that you could learn how to relate and be intimate through word and connect through words rather than through the physical is an incredibly important ingredient and element of a successful Jewish marriage, but of a successful marriage in general. It's one of the reasons why, Baruch Hashem, in spite of all the problems we hear about, we have a pretty good track record in our community. So that's another piece. The self-control is incredibly important. Make it into a goal. Understand that if there's nothing tougher, but that the benefits are incredible. Understand kolos kolos kashos, but it gets easier with time. And understand that maybe if you figure out how to ride the wave and come up with a set of a toolbox of coping mechanisms that work for you to take you from passive to active and from threat to challenge, hopefully we'll all be zocha to be able to realize our goals in this important area. Thank you.
We'll take questions now. I'm just going to go around and collect any cards people ask about.
We're going to assume that all your questions are about your roommate, okay?
And while we do that, hopefully quietly, if people want to raise their hands and just pose any questions, we can certainly go that way also. So,
yeah. I'll just start passing the cards while people are... How does a person deal with maybe parents, for example, or other authoritative figures in his life that try and push him, that don't understand Judaism the same way as we do, and that push him to be more normal, in a sense, and to be proactive in ways that the general world is in, like, Judaism?
I'll give it over to Rav Twersky. Let me just talk about it. There's a fascinating study that came out fairly recently that blew me away. It was a study published in a leading medical journal that said that for the first time, more than 50% of young adults in the United States say that they wish that they had waited longer before becoming sexually active. That's answer number one. What's that about? Okay? They wish they had waited longer. That's number one. Number two is that there's some evidence that not only is it showing itself in young adulthood, was saying that was empty, but that the first year after a high school age person gets pulled into sexual activity, their grades drop, their depression level goes up, they just become, in general, less happy people. Why is that? It's because we're not designed to have such a powerful force distract us from the important tasks of adolescence. And in fact, there's about to be launched by the OU a site called, I think, Abstinence, by the MTSY, abstinence.com. I don't think it's quite released yet. But it shows some fascinating statistics about how there's a sea change in activity in this area out there. That in fact, kids at high school and in college who are controlling themselves, it's going up quite a bit. Not for religious reasons, but purely because people are realizing this stuff is dangerous stuff. And it's not associated with health. So the answer to the people in the mainstream, which I know it's there, and I know you know, there's a lot of problems out there. But the main point I'm making is that the fact that more than half of young adults wish they had waited, I think is the answer to people like that. And I was like, I'm not saying, and you don't have to convince them, but you can convince yourselves that way. In on this handout, I think I have the data and the citations for that study.
Not too much to add to what Dr. has said, but in general, when there's sort of a, I guess, ideological gap between a Talmud and his parents, I think it's very important, A, to articulate as well and as cogently as possible what one's issues are with, and why one does not want to get involved in certain areas. And second of all, it's also important to sort of emphasize whatever common ground does exist. Meaning, so if parents think that not going to movies that one is not normal, because the parents just never had the chemux to understand any better than that. No fault of theirs necessarily. And because of that, so they think that their son never relaxes. They think that that their son he isn't normal. So I think it's very important to show parents to the extent that it's true. No, I do relax. I play basketball. I jog. To the extent that parents might think that a guy's determination to learn means that his head's only in the clouds and he doesn't have his feet in the ground. If he has a definite plan in terms of oh, he's going to enter chinuch, he's going to do this, he's going to do that. So as much as possible, you always want to highlight the common ground, and then that, you know, is the best gestalt you can make, that the parents will be open and receptive to seeing that that it's really just because you have a genuine issue and that your commitments don't allow you to go along in other areas.
These are three questions that are specifically for you.
The question is, if we set preventive measures for ourselves, how do we prevent ourselves from setting boundaries that are too strict that we end up failing? The question is an excellent one. It's also very broad. It's hard to just give a general a general answer. If one is dealing with actual Isurim, right? If it's a question of looking for to avoid actual Isurim, one's goal is to try to succeed in cold turkey. The same way, if you're trying to kick the habit of smoking, you know, the best way is not to say, well, I'll taper down from 5 packs a day to 4 packs a day. So for that reason and many other reasons, a person is not going to say that, well, I'll try to taper down from 5 instances of being nichshel to 4. So it's certainly not too strict that one's goal is to eliminate Isurim entirely. That's not too strict. I think common sense and intuition is probably your best guide. Obviously, one's
preventive measures, the status of the notion is not going to be that I'm not going to leave my room. So there's a common sense and element and an element of intuition which comes into play to whatever degree that a person is unsure, then maybe this is an occasion where he would benefit from some personalized guidance. Maybe we'll alternate questions. So I guess that everyone's listening.
Sure. The question is, how do you work on these issues in the midst of chronic stress or depression? Right, so that to the extent that we know that stress and depression is a risk factor for getting pulled more into the cycle that we were talking about, it's an excellent question. And the answer is in some ways, I'm going to sound simplistic, but it's real. The answer is that in dealing with stress or dealing with depression, we have certain choices about how to deal with it. The most effective, for example, let's talk about stress. The most effective stress reducers are not in this area. There's a beautiful verse from Rav Palm. I remember Rav Palm was the Hasidical Bracha, where he talks about, I don't remember the context exactly, but it had to do with I'll just tell you the bottom line take home message. He says, you know if pleasure and happiness is real based on how you feel the morning after. Okay? Based on how you feel the morning after, right? It's based on, okay. I know where it is. Based on Leo the Regal. When people come back, so he was diagnosed in something in the Lashon of the Pasuk there that, what is it, Sameach v'tov lev or something, that it's the real happiness, real simcha, is when you have it afterwards. So you're coming back from being olerego, or you're coming back from a simcha shel mitzvah, and you still, there's an afterglow of happiness. I think that could be taken to this area as well, right? So in terms of stress reduction, there are healthy forms of stress reduction, and there are healthy forms of dealing with depression, healthy forms of stress reduction. There's a whole list of things that can be done. Ranging from the way you think to the way you reach out to other people, to physical exercise, to throw yourselves into learning. It depends on the person. But it's usually a toolbox of 5-6 approaches. We have 13. We have 13 approaches when we do research on this, in terms of research on efficacy of various kinds of treatments for stress, and none of them involve being nichshol in terms of physical relationships, because it doesn't pass the yardstick of feeling good the next morning. So that's basically it.
The question reads, although creating a siyog seems to be the only way to fight this yetzer hara, there are many times when creating that siyog may be impossible, like when somebody enters the workforce or graduate school. How can that siyog remain strong even outside the walls of a yeshiva? The question again is a very, very good one. I think part of the answer is that the work situation that a person looks for has to be affected by these considerations. There are different work environments, not only within different professions, but within the same profession, that there are different work environments. And the same way, I don't know, this is a little bit of an anachronistic example, but if one work environment doesn't have a no smoking policy, and the other one does, so then you're going to send your resume to the one which has the no smoking policy, because even the secondhand smoke disturbs you a lot. So I think that
when entering the workforce, that's part of the assessment that one makes initially in terms of where one is headed, and then specifically in terms of what law firm or what workplace one goes to. But this has to be part of the cheshbon, and not it's not uniformly stone barmer. There's a lot of stone barmer, but it's not. Not uniformly stone barmer, and it has to influence and affect our decisions. The problem is a real one. But I think a person has to be creative. Certainly, many people who work in computers now are able to work from home and don't even go into the workplace. And there's also, again, there's a whole range of factors which a person needs to think about ahead of time, rather than just sort of take it as a given that, well, I want to be a lawyer and I want to work in this firm, and in this firm the secretaries all dress in a way which makes it impossible. I mean, there's an insurance item. I think instead of taking that as a given, a person has to design and then look to match a work environment which is consistent with as much as possible with the values of the firm.
Yeah, the question is, and it's another excellent question, is Dr. Michelle's study, the longitudinal study on self-control in preschoolers, which is, I think, was 3 and 4 year olds, but the last time I read it was 4 year olds. Is he capturing, is his research team capturing something that could be taught? Or is it capturing something that is inborn? Some people just born with the basic capacity to be better at controlling themselves. And I think the answer to that is, my guess is that it probably is. There's a strong, we know that some people find much more challenges, for example, in this area. Some people are very sensual. Some people have a very strong sexual drive. Some people are incredibly pulled in this direction. And some people are born with excellent capacity for self-control. But we also know that everybody has their own challenge. We know that there isn't a personalized, as Retorsky said a little bit earlier, who doesn't have a set of challenges that they could overcome. And we know that there's a set of questions about homosexuality that we're at that is a similar issue. What happens if you're pulled very, very strongly in a certain area? So we know that on the one hand, the tsar is greater for that person, but the Torah brooks no exceptions in terms of the basic guidelines. So yes, there's a tremendous amount of variability in terms of individual challenges. I've never met anybody who doesn't have challenges. I sit down with somebody, you know, for 10 minutes, and it's pretty easy to find out what their challenges are. It's impossible. Everybody has something. I always wondered what their unique challenges and unique advantages to a given temperament. So, for example, we know that people who were born in a way that they're very anxious, about 15% of the population, are very nervous types, they're shy. They get very nervous about certain novel situations. So you wonder why, what's the purpose for that? And it turns out that in studies of monkeys, the naturalistic monkey lens, right, we're told we can learn from ants, we can certainly learn from monkeys as well. It's the 15% of monkeys who are anxious who, if they're given stability, they grow up to be the leaders of the pack. Because there's something very adaptive about being anxious. Anxious people connect very strongly to others. Anxious people take life very seriously. And part of anxiety is leadership qualities. And I understood it. Just about any temperament had great positive aspects of it. So attention deficit people are the ones who run institutions, and I see the, I have a friend who's, the Rosh Yeshiva of one of the most successful K through base Medrash yeshivas in this country. And every time he sees me, he just calls me, he says, help, let's come here. He says, if you put me on Ritalin when I was a kid, there'd never be this yeshiva, would never be here. You know, and he makes me feel, and he's probably right. He's probably right, okay? We need everything. But I always wondered, why the obnoxious temperament? Why do we have, why, you know, somebody who cries and is negative and is difficult? And then I saw a study that showed that during during the famine in Ethiopia, it was the kids with difficult temperaments who were most likely to survive. Because they cried in such an obnoxious way, they were the ones most likely to be fed. Okay, so there's a reason for everything, but there are unbelievable challenges for people who are not born with self-control and not born with, let's say, an easy ability to control this particular area. But yeah, that was a very good call. I mean, my guess is that if you look carefully at Dr. Michelle's data, there's a strong biological component. But that doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Yeah. You know, as you get down in these to the last few, the questions just get tougher. Okay, so here's the one that's I'm not sure this is the place. The homosexuality one actually, I would suggest. I don't know if this is the place for it. People who take the pastoral classes, we know that we have a whole lecture, and we're willing also, as you know, we have, the only thing I'd recommend is if you have a real interest in this, you're willing, there's an approach that is explained in a book by Rappaport and Kedayan in England that is fairly, interesting approach. You see Rappaport's book at all? Rev Willig read it and liked a lot of it, okay? Almost all of it. So that's one approach, but it probably, to give it the right kind of coverage, I think it's probably not for tonight. It's a very important area, except that one person had a question. One of the questions was, isn't it possible that if you totally control yourself in terms of relationships with women, that it's going to bring out homosexual behavior? Okay, so legitimate question. It's a legitimate question. And the answer is that, to my knowledge, and again, this is an area that I've done a fair amount of clinical work in, it's true that in a dormitory setting, that can happen. It's possible that it could happen. To the point that there's some Russian yeshiva that will not have dormitory rooms with two guys. They'll only have three guys in the dormitory room because they recognize that this is, it's a temptation. I'll just tell you, though, that if, in fact, such a difficulty comes up, in my experience, it's never been something that became a permanent part of their sexual orientation. If it's something that comes between two consenting adults, as a result of being mischel because of being in an all-male environment and having no other outlet. I've never known it to be permanent. And it leads to a much more complex set of questions. So maybe, did you want to address that?
Only perhaps, yeah. Just to add. My guess is that if avoiding heterosexual michshol leads to homosexual michshol, then I think that it's virtually a given that one is not taking the correct measures to avoid the heterosexual issue. It's quite clear that if it's just being deflected, it's not approaching it correctly. I think some of the strategies that we've been discussing this evening, and perhaps the most important one, which I neglected to mention, the Rambam quote at the end of Hilchos Tetzaveh Biya, and this is very much consistent with what Dr. Salkovitz was talking about, how a person doesn't, you can't resolve not to think about a pink elephant. But if you're busy thinking about gray horses, then your mind is going to be preoccupied, and you're not going to think about the pink elephant. So lahavdil, lahavdil, lahavdil. So the Rambam quotes that the machshavas and taivas that a person has only come when belayed ponim min hachochma. When there's a vacuum. There's a vacuum in terms of what our mind is preoccupied with. So then belayed ponim min hachochma. So then, when there's this vacuum, when there's this void, so then the natural drives and urges that we have will fill that void, will fill the vacuum. But to the extent that there is no void, there is no vacuum, that a person is productively engaged. Okay, so if he's a big master, he can be productively engaged, like the Rambam says the whole time, with Divrei Torah or Chochmah. If he needs a break from learning, if he's learned as much as he can learn now, but let him be engaged productively with other things. So if one takes the right approach, I think, to dealing with the issue of controlling the heterosexual urges, I don't think they're going to be deflected and translate into homosexual urges. And if that's happening, it points to the fact that a person is not really going about the challenge the right way. And another thing which I had intended to mention before, you know, one component of this whole equation in terms of, you know, seeking to attain and maintain Kedusha in today's world and age, it's helpful to mention that the Satan Aura said about 1950. Well, the Emes says we can go back even further than that, right? The Gemara in Kiddushin very, very strongly advocates early marriage. And who was it who said that the reason I'm better than my peers is because I got married at a chisur?
If I'd been 14, he
says.
Yeah,
because I got married at 16, and if I would have got married at 14, I would have been even better. Now, obviously, you know, very, very literally, we're not ready for many reasons to get married at age 14 or at age 16. But certainly early marriage, if a person is emotionally ready for it, is definitely part of the equation, not to prolong the nisyonos. You know, when Chazal say the Linda Torah Darachet, that the Olam Yilmad Adam Umnus, Yilmad Adam Torah Achakach and Yilmad Umnus, and Achakach Isa Isha, the reason Chazal formulated that is Darachet as opposed to Halacha Psuka. And the reason for that is that was excellent advice when, at age 13, so you became an apprentice, and you learned how to make horseshoes, and so you had that apprenticeship for 5 years, and by the time Ben Shimon Esrei L'chusa, so you already had your umnus, and you could follow that. Nowadays, many professions that a person is going to enter, he's not going to have the credentials, the qualifications to enter it until he's, I don't know, 23, 24, whatever the case may be, it just doesn't work. So to hold the line on, no, well, first you have to be totally finished with your schooling and only then to get married, it doesn't work anymore. And Chazal knew it, which is why Chazal never said that the Torah was telling us a halacha. It was Linda Torah Derech Eretz, to the extent that it's possible. So then, all things being equal, is Yilmad Odom Umnus, find a way to be self-supporting and then get married. Bizman Hazeh, it just often doesn't work that way. And part of the approach to this whole issue is, again, provided that a person is ready emotionally in terms of maturity, is marriage at a young age.
Yeah. I think this is, actually, why don't we take from, I think we handled most of the questions, I think. There's a question here, which I think was, what is the effect of harsh and extreme restrictions on marital relationships? And also, is imposition of artificial restrictions using the internet and library a healthy approach for exacerbating the problem? You know, Lakewood authored the internet, right? The question is, how effective has that ISTR been, okay? And maybe you could do it in a controlled community of about 7,000 families. I don't know that you could do it in less controlled communities. I'm not even sure that from what the people who live there, or the leadership who I've met with, you know, to discuss similar issues, I'm not so sure how successful it is. There's a beautiful, I think it's Rosham Shnerfal Hirsch on Al Odos Beno, and it's very relevant to this, right? Says that Avram, after Yishmael is passed away, he's worried Al Odos Beno. So most Mefarshim understand it to mean he's worried about Yishmael. Rosham Shnerfal Hirsch says no, he's worried about Yitzchak. That now Yitzchak, who's the Tam, is going to be raised in a home where he's not exposed to the Yishmael's of the world. And he's very worried about Yishmael, about Yitzchak's lack of exposure. Really very interesting kind of way of looking at it. So the question is, and this is the question about the philosophy of Yeshiva University versus the philosophy of a Lakewood, let's say, is the question is the answer to totally push it away with the hope that when you need it for business, you'll learn what you need to, and that you push it away and you'll be fine with it when you're finally, you know, you'll be more mature, which I could see. I understand that logic. Or do we embrace the world in a way that we're careful about actualizing our values and living the Torah that we've been taught? And that's a real question. So the bottom line answer I could give as a psychologist to the question of are artificial restrictions like using the internet and the library a healthy approach or exacerbating problems? I would say that, like Retorsky was saying before, it depends. If this is an area that's equivalent to putting the knobs on the light switches, then I don't think it's an unhealthy approach at all. I think that if it's an area that you're struggling with and you build that kind of get there, then why not? Why not? We're not saying no internet at all. We're saying internet on the second floor of the library where people could see you. I don't see anything wrong with that. That's a reasonable thing that's very much an accepted part, I think, of self-control and psychology in general. You know, you build Gedarim. Gedarim work. Anyway, I think I sense that people... should we have more questions? Yeah.
Just on that topic, yeah. I'm sorry to use this graphic example. I don't know, maybe it's not shaykh to this, but like if you have a pet and it goes to the bathroom in the house, like a classic example, like on television or whatever, that we have is like we cover it up with newspapers or whatever, but eventually you keep covering it up, the smell is still there, but you know, it's still there. And is there granted the Yetzer Hara is within us and we have to control it and fight it, is there a way of not maybe exacerbating the problem or covering up the problem, but actually dealing with the Yetzer Hara in a way, or is it something that has to be accepted and then you just have to find ways to deal with this?
I mean, I think what I've been arguing tonight is that you have to, that there's no such thing as completely eradicating the Yetzer Hara. I don't think there is. I don't know that it's maybe certain incredibly controlled people could do that. It's a struggle, and that struggle is part of the engine of our growth. If you look in today's New York Times, front page, bottom story, it's about what do you do with people who are pedophiles, people who are abusers. And they find that nothing has worked, including extreme approaches. Extreme approaches. Some people have such an incredibly, you can't control it. And they end, that doesn't mean all the things we're talking about like riding the wave and setting goals and, all the recommendations that were made by both of us, I think are arguing for not a subject. You can't change the way we're designed. You could change the way we handle those temptations. And we grow through it. And it's what makes us who we are, and it's what brings us to Kedusha, right? I mean, is that sort of right?
I would just expand on that a little bit. It's a very important question. I think, in general, we deal with challenges, whether it's in the area we're talking about tonight, whether it's in other areas, on two levels. One is more on a behavioral level, which really doesn't necessarily, you're not at least initially attacking the core yetzer hara, which is, look, a person knows that he has the yetzer hara to go to sites on the internet which are very antithetical to everything he believes in and stands for, the Ben Torah, which are against Torah. So just on a behavioral level, he has to. You tell him not to go close to a vineyard. Score, lekamelo sikur. You tell him that he shouldn't go close to the vineyard. He shouldn't be maybe atmali denisayim, and that's part of dealing with the yetzer hara is taking those preventive measures and literally hakokos, distancing himself from the yetzer hara. So we certainly do contend and struggle with the yetzer hara on that level. I think on the other hand, what we also try to do is, let's say to follow up on another analogy, is in addition to telling him don't go close to the vineyard, so that you won't subject yourself to that temptation, we also, again, and I think maybe this is the level on to which you're referring, we also want that the Nazir should also seek to bring himself to a level where when he sees a grape, he doesn't see something enticing for its physical pleasure, but he sees something which represents a violation of Ratzon Hashem. He sees something which will distance him from Ratzon Hashem. So, Moshe L'ma Adov Adov, if you have a person who has severe allergies, food allergies. So if he eats peanuts, so he can have a harmless plan, such a severe reaction, maybe it could even be fatal. So when he becomes aware of that, and maybe he even had a brush with death, a harmless plan, but when he wasn't aware of it. So when he sees the peanut, he doesn't have much of a yetzer hara to eat that peanut, because when he sees it, his association with it is that it brings back the memory of that terrible reaction it had. So I think you're absolutely correct that we do seek also, if I know that right here there's a publication with all kinds of pornographic material. So again, so on one level, let's quickly get rid of it. On another level, ultimately, we certainly do seek to internalize that our perception of that shouldn't be something, oh, which is potentially gratifying, but to see it as a source of tumah, and that goes more to the level of internalizing. So we take sort of behavioral precautions, behavioral hafakas, and then we also try to internalize certain values and perspectives which just make it not enticing. It doesn't uproot the yetzer hara, but it certainly directs it and channels it. It doesn't uproot the yetzer hara. A person is still gonna get married, and he's still gonna lead a normal married life with his wife. But what maybe he once experienced as a temptation to be mezana now becomes just so repulsive, because what it represents for him is no longer the gratification. But what he's internalized is that what it represents is tumma, what it represents is distancing him from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And yes, so I think we do struggle on both levels. And finally, the question which Dr. Pelkowitz addressed before, in terms of everyone's challenges, I'll just leave you with this. There's a very beautiful he'ora from the Yaakov Moshe Chalap, the grandfather of our Rabbi Chalap here. He has a remarkable he'ora. He says, if you look at the Rambam, the beginning tells us Deus. So when the Rambam describes different types, Rambam says that some people are so interested in amassing money that they want to be in the Forbes top 50, and others are so disinterested in money they're not even interested in earning enough to pay the rent. And some people have this hedonistic impulse and they eat much too much. And some people you can't even get them to eat enough to keep body and soul together, and so on and so forth. Yaakov Moshe Chalap says there's something missing from all these descriptions of character types. Rambam doesn't describe anyone who's right on target. Rambam doesn't describe anyone who's interested in earning just enough money that he needs. He doesn't describe anyone who naturally, innately, wants to eat as much as he needs to eat. Yaakov Moshe Chalap says no one is born on target. No one is born on center. Everyone has challenges in terms of tikkun amidos, and as Dr. Pelkowitz spoke about, there's certainly one perspective on the fact of, you know, why are we given this challenge to deal with such a strong urge and drive as we have. So I heard a tape once from the Rav, and he commented on the pasuk. It's in one of the Shir Malach, and he's telling, with Zachor Hashem Ladavid Eis Kol Umuso, I think the pasuk goes, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should remember for David all his years of struggle. So the Rav says, the greater the struggle, so the greater the Kedusha. And he went on to say that Al Pi Halacha, why is it that there are Shiva Minim which are associated with Eretz Yisrael? So why is it that you bench, you only say a full-fledged Birkas HaMazon over bread, but if you eat grapes, you eat pomegranates, so you say a Bracha Achas Minim Shalosh. You make an Alo Eitz, Al Pi Eitz. Rav said, because grapes, you know, there's no human investment. There's no human investment. So there's not as much of an occasion to give bracha to the Ram Shalom. If there's bread, so then you had to make it into flour, and then you had to bake it, v'chulu v'chulu. There's more human investment. The more human investment, the more struggle there is, so the more kedusha is created. So the Maisa, the Ram Shalom, lets us literally become shutfim with him in creating life, in perpetuating life. There's no area in which there's a need for greater Kedusha. In order for to have that capacity, there has to be struggle involved. If it weren't such a strong urge, if it weren't such a strong drive, if there weren't a need to exercise such self-control, that we couldn't attain those levels of Kedusha, because it's not only the Fum Tzara Agra, but Zuchor Hashem Adar Yizkel Nusa, it's also the Fum Tzara, the Kedusha that ensues. So Halavai, we should all be Zohar to this Kaddish and be sent to Russia.
Thank you very much again to Dr. Tversky, Dr. Pelkowitz on this very crucial topic.